This message is from the teaching ministry of Stephen Davey. For information, visit wisdomonline.org.
Sylvester Graham was born in 1794. His name would soon become a household name, and his passion would become his highest calling. Even though he only lived for 57 years, his legacy today is known all around this country and other countries. By the early 1830s, Sylvester had become a pastor and had established himself as a fiery temperance lecturer. Oddly enough, however, he became strangely convinced that the way to cure alcoholism was vegetarianism. A strict diet of vegetables, he preached, would cure the longing for rum. He also taught that carnal desires could be cured by eating foods made from ground wheat flour, which came to be known as Graham flour. He would become known abroad for his love of wheat products. In fact, he was called the poet of bran bread and pumpkins. Later on, this story goes on. He switched trying to get people to stop drinking to trying to get people to just simply stop eating any bread that was not made from whole wheat. He caused such a stir in 1847 that a riot broke out in Boston with all the Bostonian bakers intent on lynching this madman, which they had nicknamed him. Sylvester Graham was hurting their business. The police at this event were unable to control the crowd outside a lecture hall where Graham was actually speaking on this subject. But finally, some of Graham's followers poured grease from the second-story window down on top of the lynch mob, and that dispersed them, and Graham escaped with his life. Undeterred, he continued to lecture on the evils of meat and white flour and the need to eat things made from wheat. His legacy, even though Sylvester Graham was a Presbyterian pastor, his ministry bore little fruit, but his passion for ground wheat flour lived on. In fact, you can still buy it today if you haven't guessed already. It's in a cracker, the Graham cracker, invented by Sylvester and named in honor of himself. How's that for passion? What a wonderful thing to pursue. And all those of you that think it ought to be whole wheat, I'm not making fun of you, but his legacy was a cracker. Before you think out loud, what a weird man, ask yourself the question, what is your passion? What do you feel strongly about? I got a neighbor a couple of blocks over. I know his passion is his classic car. Perhaps for you, it's a boat or a wardrobe. Maybe for you, it's a business that you have given yourself and every ounce of thought and time to. Maybe it's jewelry. These are all inheritances left behind, but what will your lasting legacy be? Webster defines legacy as something handed down from one generation to the next. It can be property, riches, awards, but more than anything else, the significant legacies in our lives have nothing to do with stuff like that. They have to do with a name. They have to do with a character. They have to do with a reputation. No son or daughter will ever grow up and say, my dad was a wonderful man because he was rich. Or my father was a wonderful father because he owned 3 companies and had 1,000 employees. Or, you know, my dad was a wonderful man because of the way he always brought home the paycheck. We never missed a meal. No kid will ever say that. See, it's possible for a child to be well fed, but starving for what really matters in life. So I want to speak to those of us today who call ourselves men. In fact, beyond fathers, I want to speak to men and in general. And I want you to walk away with this thought, and I knew it's a bizarre illustration that I started with because I don't want you to ever forget it. Don't leave your kids crackers. Leave them character. But I want to start by encouraging men. I think men need to be encouraged more than anything else. Let me say something about the job the average father in the church is doing in the home. It's interesting that even the world is beginning to take note. And all those polls and all those surveys Well, here's one that you won't hear often, but I think it ought to be said. USA Today, in fact, rocked the community and drew heated reaction and response to this particular article that they published in 2004 entitled, "Do Evangelical Protestant Fathers Really Know Best?" The article went on to say, which was amazing that they would say it in this politically correct environment where religion is not supposed to affect anything. They said this, and I quote, "Religious congregations give young families social support and enforce certain norms about what it means to be a good father. According to recent findings, evangelical Protestant men are more likely to show affection toward their children than religiously unaffiliated men. They are more likely to want to know what's going on in their children's lives, and committed Protestant men have the lowest rate of domestic violence of any singular group in the United States of America." Isn't that great? Isn't that amazing that you could read that in the newspaper? But it would be true. So in the climate of where the church is now, where a monogamous, faithful, concerned, involved father is usually the brunt end of a crude joke or a disrespectful movie or sitcom, let me say, first of all, congratulations on your commitment to your family. Congratulations to your commitment to your children. Congratulations on your commitment to character, so much so that our world today knows that if you're a Protestant and you're a father, that you're more likely to be involved and care and be loving than men in general in the rest of this country. So I say congratulations to you men. A few weeks ago, I told my grown children to watch the commercials between the Stanley Cup and the World Cup. We've been watching a lot of commercials. I told them to watch the commercials that show a father. Invariably, I said, the man will be out of touch, he will be ignorant, or he will be uncaring, or he will be gullible, or he will be unaware, or he will be completely out of date. So we've begun watching them with that in mind, and it's amazing how true that is. Now, it would help for men to stop wearing dark socks with their shorts when they go cut the grass. We could at least make that a little improvement, couldn't we? Gentlemen, in an ever-increasing hostile environment of values and purity and morality and fidelity and true spirituality, I invite your attention today to a man who left a legacy worth following, Genesis chapter 5. In the early chapters of Genesis, God records for us the very first family tree. In Genesis 4, you have the line of Adam through Cain, and it is a wicked line. In Genesis chapter 5, you have the line of Adam through Seth, a godly line. By the time the seventh generation of Cain is roaming the earth, that particular part of the family tree, it will be utterly corrupt and wicked. In fact, the seventh generation of Cain represented, let me just give you a review for the sake of time, he's represented by Lamech, who will sing in one particular verse of how proud he is that he's killed a boy. He is so proud of the fact that he's gotten revenge. He's struck back that he composes the first form of lyric. And he sings of his arrogant pride. He brags that he is 70 times more evil than his forefather Cain. He says, if Cain, who killed his brother Abel, was something to sing about, I am 70 times more evil, more wicked. Sing of me. The line of Cain was corrupt and evil and as far away from God as they could be. The other side of the family tree was very different. The line comes from Seth, who was born to Adam and Eve after Abel was killed. And this is a godly line. While the seventh from Cain is the epitome of murder and arrogance and evil, the seventh generation from Seth is a man named Enoch, whose name means dedicated, and he will live up to that name. Look at verse 21 of Genesis chapter 5. We're given just a brief biography of this wonderful legacy. And Enoch lived 65 years and became the father of Methuselah. Then Enoch walked with God 300 years after he became the father of Methuselah, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Enoch were 365 years. And Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. Now you can't miss, in fact you ought to underline, the double reference to the fact that Enoch walked with God. And it begs the question, what does it mean to walk with God? Well, it represents categorically walking in a way that pleases God. In fact, this verb, eresteo, here in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, known as the Septuagint, is a word that could literally be translated pleasing to God. To please God and to walk with God are synonymous biblical phrases. Now, the phrase to walk with God appears often in the New Testament. This verb shows up often and gives us a little more insight on what it means to walk with God. Paul told the Romans to walk in newness of life, Romans 6, verse 4. Walk in the light of the fact that they are now committed to Jesus Christ. Walk in the light of their public profession of baptism, he says there. Probably a reference to spirit baptism as much as water. Paul reminded the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians 5:7 that we are to walk by faith, not by sight. He warned the Galatian believers that they're to walk by the Spirit, so they'll not carry out the desires of the flesh, Galatians 5:16, which would go exactly, entirely against Sylvester's view that eating whole wheat keeps you from carnal activity. No, walking after the Spirit keeps you from following the desires of the flesh. You get up in the morning, gentlemen and ladies, young people, and you say, Father, by the power of your Holy Spirit who resides within me, I want to walk today in a pure and wholesome manner. And when I trip up throughout the day, convict me, remind me of my dedication to walk with you, and allow me to confess quickly and get back in step with you. See, walking with God, ladies and gentlemen, doesn't necessarily mean you sin less often. It means you confess more quickly. Furthermore, Paul told the Ephesians to walk in love, just as Christ also loved you and gave himself up for us, Ephesians 5, 2. The Apostle John tells us that holiness is an ingredient of walking with God. He says in 1 John 1, 5 to 7, this is the message we have heard from him and announced to you. God is light, and in him there is no darkness at all. If we say that we have fellowship with him, and yet walk in the darkness, we lie and do not practice the truth. But if we walk in the light, as he himself is in the light, we have fellowship with one another. Later, John the Apostle gives us that glorious visual picture of the heavenly city where this verb is used again, where he tells us that the believers will walk with God robed in garments of white. Revelation chapter 3 verse 4. The verb peripateo, which shows up often, means simply to walk around. It's almost a casual word. It means to walk about. And if you were a Canadian, you would use that phrase easily. Walk about. It means to conduct oneself in the normal events of life. It isn't something that you get dressed up for and you come to church to walk with God. No, it's a reference to walking normally through the course of the events of your life. Walking in faith, with an attitude of love, with surrender to the Spirit of God, in newness of life, with a desire for holiness, in order to walk with somebody. Think about it this way. There are several things that you have to agree upon ahead of time. You have to agree on the place where you're headed. You can't walk with someone if you're not heading to the same place. You have to agree not only on the place where you want to go, but you got to agree on the same path. Now, it's possible to arrive at the same destination and take different routes. That's true. My family takes several automobiles. We're going to end up at the same place, but we're taking different routes. We're going to meet at the restaurant, but somebody's going to go to Michael's first, somebody's going to go to the bookstore, somebody's going to go earlier and save seats. But if you're going to walk with someone or travel with them, you have to agree on the place and you have to agree on the path in order to go together. You also have to agree on the same pace. If you walk with someone, that means you're not 10 blocks behind them or 10 steps in front of them. If you are, you're not walking with them. Fourth, you have to relate to the same principle of nature. In other words, you have to have a corresponding nature to walk with someone else. Think of the difference in this light. Some animals can become good companions to people. My dog, Patches, is a wonderful companion to me. And the older she gets and the older I get, the softer I'm getting. In fact, now she can sleep in the garage at night. I'm getting soft. Well, they can be loyal and sensitive to their owners, and a close relationship can develop over the years. But humans cannot fellowship with even the smartest and most devoted animal because our natures are different. They do not correspond. Animals can offer companionship, but not fellowship. We can walk with our dog in a way that really we're taking them for a walk, but we don't walk with them in a way that assumes fellowship with them and communion. Peter wrote that human beings are in trouble. They cannot walk with God because they are different natures. They can't enjoy communion or fellowship unless something dramatic happens. That happens at conversion, where Peter says, we become partakers of the divine nature. We share in the principle of Christ's own nature. Therefore, we can fellowship with God. Without that corresponding nature, we're dead spiritually in trespasses and sins. But we must be made alive in Christ by the power of regeneration and His nature, which comes to literally reside within us, so that we now have a new nature. And we can now commune and fellowship and communicate. We can walk with God. If I said to you, listen, why don't I stop by your house today after church and let's take a walk together? You'd say, well, I'm taking a nap. Well, after your nap, I'll come by, okay? Well, then we walk. Well, that presupposes a number of things. It presupposes we've agreed on the place we want to go. We share the same principle of nature. We agree on the path and we agree on the pace. So Enoch agreed in all those things with God. Enoch walked with God for 300 years. What an incredible legacy. What I think is remarkable is when I meet somebody who says, I've walked with God for 30 years or 50 years or 70. Can you imagine 300 years? Aren't you glad it's not a race with God, no matter how long it is? It isn't a quick run. It isn't a hop, skip, and a jump. It's a walk. Now, what caused Enoch at 65 years of age to begin to walk the path, to go to the same place, to choose the pace of God? Well, we're told back in verse 22, something significant happened. Then Enoch walked with God 300 years after he became the father of Methuselah. Something ignited in him a passion to change from being passive about God to being passionate for God. He went from spiritual apathy to spiritual activity. Something revolutionary occurred in his life. It's very simple. He became a father. For some of you dads, that made a difference in your life, just like with Enoch. You weren't walking with God. You didn't care about God. But suddenly, that first sight, the first cry, maybe holding the baby for the first time, something happened in you, and maybe you, like me, standing in that delivery room holding that child, you found yourself asking yourself the question, what do I do now? And beyond that, Lord, help me, because I do not know even where to begin. For Enoch, he recognized that for the first 65 years of his life, no one was taking notes, but everything changed with little Methuselah. Maybe he realized, as many of you have, that you will become larger than life to your child. You will define the word father. You will in a large way either handicap them or help them in understanding what a relationship with their Heavenly Father is like, simply by the reference, Father. You see, the question is not whether your child will have a relationship with God. The question is, what kind of relationship will your children have with God? What's yours like? The question is not, will your children develop spiritually? The question is, how will they develop spiritually? And most often, especially in the early years, and even in later years that have to, in many situations or illustrations, be overcome, they will develop just like their dad developed. How are you developing, Dad? One author wrote, just this week, I read a newspaper account of a 13-year-old boy who saved his brother's life by driving him to a hospital in his father's car. Never having driven before, his explanation was simple. I just did what I saw my father do. How did you know how to drive a car? I watched my father and did what I saw him do. Why did you refuse to argue with that neighbor who said unkind things? I did what I saw my father do. Well, why'd you get mad and throw your wrench at the lawnmower? Well, I did what I saw my father do. Well, why'd you get those adult channels on cable TV? I did what I saw my father do. Why'd you stick it out in that difficult job day after day, year after year? I did what I saw my father do. Why'd you give the clerk back the money they overpaid when they gave you your change? Why do you teach third grade boys after your kids are grown and gone? Why do you pray and thank God for good times and bad times? I'm just doing what I saw my father do. Maybe at the age of 65, holding his newborn son, Enoch knew that he had been on the path of Cain instead of the path of Seth. And he realized somebody was going to be watching him from that day forward. Well, there's really more to this turnaround. Enoch named his son Methuselah. What a name, huh? Why did he name him that? So he could embarrass him every time he registered for classes or for his driver's license. I don't know. The name was actually a prophetic announcement, and it means when he is dead, it will come. Strange. Simply put, Enoch had been given revelation from God. The judgment was coming from God, and it will come when his son dies. And Enoch not only changed his direction in life, he changed his occupation. He became a preacher. He became a prophet. And he would preach for 300 years this simple message. For the sake of time, don't turn, but let me quote what the content of his message was. It appears in the little book of Jude. We're given the content of his message as he prophesied. Behold, Enoch is preaching, the Lord will come with thousands of his holy ones to execute judgment upon all and to convict all the ungodly of all their ungodly deeds, which they have done in an ungodly way, and of all the harsh things which ungodly sinners have spoken against God. His message was basically, God is not in a very good mood with sinful man. And judgment is coming on earth. This is a prophetic reference actually to the second coming of Christ, but it will have specific application to the flood, the universal flood, the deluge, which will come as soon as Methuselah's grandson, Noah, finishes building the ark. When Methuselah was about 850 years old, Noah received word from God to begin building an ark. He'll pick up Enoch's message of judgment and warning. As soon as Methuselah dies, judgment will come. Can you imagine how odd that would have sounded to this culture, to the sons of Cain and the sons of Seth, all of whom desire, of course, to be far from God, all who disbelieve, including Methuselah's own son? Building an ark was odd enough. It had never rained on the planet. But to tie God's judgment of water to the death of some old man like Methuselah would seem odder still. But imagine with me, Methuselah is 967 years old. And Noah is hanging the door on the ark. Methuselah is 968 years old. Noah and his family have packed all the food in the ark and have stored the grain. Methuselah is 969 years old. And the animals arrive. Noah hears the message from God to board the ark around the same time he hears the news that Methuselah has just died. And for the first time in human history, mankind hears thunder and sees rain. Methuselah was a living reminder of judgment. Fathers, let me tell you, you don't need to be Enoch or Methuselah to deliver the same warning. It is appointed unto man once to die, and after that, the what? After that, the judgment. Have you told your children? Have you told them, as soon as you die, you will stand before God? Have you told them? Have you received for yourself the forgiveness of God through Christ? Have you, as a daddy, ever asked for the gift of eternal life through faith in Jesus Christ alone? Are you ready to stand before God? Or will your children do what they have seen you do and say, judgment? Yeah, that's stuff people believe in church. I don't buy it. Let me tell you, Methuselah became not only a living testimony of the coming judgment of God, he also became a wonderful illustration of the grace of God. Follow this. He lived longer than any other human being will live in human history. It's no small irony then that the judgment that will come from God is tied to a man who, when he dies, will bring the judgment, and God allows that man to live longer than anybody else ever lived. What a picture of grace and the patience of God. He has extended grace to us too. Are you alive? Are you breathing? There's still time. Are you alive? Did you just take another breath? There's still time to deal with God and accept His gift of grace. What was it like being the son of Enoch? We've got to quit, but I just had to use my imagination. What would it be like to have Enoch for a father? Is going around telling everybody, as soon as my son dies, watch out. There's going to be trouble. Well, I think he was the son of an odd man. An odd man at odds with the world. A man who preached for 300 years. A man who delivered the legacy of walking with God to everyone, not just his son. He was the son also of a lonely man. Do you understand that his message was to his cousins, his uncles, his aunts? None of them believed in him, just as they would refuse to believe Noah after him. Enoch was willing to stand alone. Methuselah was the son of a focused man who wanted to make the most of his son's life and the time that was left for the glory of God. For many fathers, it is the birth of a child that crystallizes passion and focus and courage. I recently read in Ken Canfield's book on effective fathers a story from the Olympics of 1924. Ken told this story in his book on effective habits of fathers. It was the Summer Games in Paris. Bill Havens was selected to represent the United States that year in a canoeing competition. A single paddle, a single man in a single canoe racing against other nations. A few months before the Olympics, Canfield wrote, Havens learned that his wife was due to give birth sometime during the games. He had a decision to make. The opportunity of a lifetime or the opportunity of a lifetime. He made his decision for the higher opportunity, and he stayed home. The teen left for Paris without him, and on August 1st, 1924, his son was born, 4 days after the games, if you can imagine. He could have gone after all, but he had made up his mind not to risk it in being away. Fast forward the Olympic tapes to 1952, the year the Summer Olympics were held in Helsinki. Bill received a telegram from Helsinki that he wouldn't have traded for any amount of gold. The telegram read, Dear Dad, thanks for waiting around for me to be born in 1924. I'm coming home with the gold medal you could have won your loving son, Frank. That legacy will never leave that son. It obviously marked him for life. Methuselah's daddy was odd, patient, courageous, pure, focused. One more thing. Methuselah was ultimately the son of a missing man. Genesis 5 tells us that God took Enoch. Literally, he translated him without death into paradise. For Enoch, one author wrote, it was merely a change of location, not a change of company. His family probably suspected foul play. He's missing. Does anybody know where he is? No, we don't. And they must have searched. Maybe it was an accident, maybe an abduction, maybe a wild animal. No one knew for sure. We do. We do. God took him. The old British expositor from the last century, G. Campbell Morgan, wrote it in his commentary this way. He said, Enoch was a man who used to go for long walks with God. How did it end? One day they walked on and on and on, and when they had gone so far, God turned and said to him, Enoch, you're a long way from home. Why don't you come on home with me? Now that's a legacy. A man who walked with God became a man who walked away with God. That'd be something to tell the grandkids, wouldn't it? Well, in case you've forgotten, you can tell your kids the same possibility exists for you too. Should Christ come for his church right now in the rapture? We're told in 1 Thessalonians 4 that at the shout, at the trumpet of God, we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and thus we shall always be with the Lord. You can be walking with God and suddenly be called away, experiencing what Enoch experienced, if he should come today. One thing's for sure, let's leave this kind of legacy, walking with God now, anticipating the fact that we might walk away with God at any moment, but knowing that we will walk one day with God in heaven forever. Ladies and gentlemen, especially fathers, don't leave your family crackers for legacies. Let your children be able to say of you, my dad walked with God.
You've been listening to the teaching ministry of Stephen Davey. This message is copyrighted and may be shared, but not sold or altered. For information or to access more resources, visit wisdomonline.org.